Hello, hello. This is Andre Traversa. You are listening to The Cosmic Citizen. That was the lovely voice of Francil Garwin, who has just done so much wonderful music for the Urantia community as well as for those outside of it. You can look at her music at francil.com. That's FRANCYL, francil.com. My co-host Paula Thompson is with me this morning. Paula, are you with us today?
Of course. Hi, everyone.
I know you are. I know you are. how can I doubt your presence here? Speaking of those outside the Urantia community, I'm so excited, Paula, because today we're going to start the first of several shows that I'm calling the Outside the Box series. And the Outside the Box series is a series of shows where we interview people who are not Urantia book readers, but who people who I believe are on the cutting edge of science, religion, and philosophy, and who are doing some really groundbreaking work. Before I do that, before I introduce our guest, actually, I want to make a shameless plug. I'll put in a shameless plug, and I'm going to put in a shameless plug for our guest as well, but let me put in a shameless plug for myself here first. I'm going to do a self-promotional thing today. Yes, I know. As people may know, my last name is Andre Traversa. Sometimes people call me Andre Controversa. I spread controversy wherever I go. Why do you think I'm in talk radio? Anyway, some of you may not know this, but I am trying to go into business as a life coach. For those of you who don't know, life coaching is a kind of counseling, but it's not therapy. And I have just got my website up, which is controversialcoach.com. So if anybody's interested, you can see my coaching philosophy, what my views on human nature are, why I think it's hard for people to change, how people can change, all that kind of stuff. I've got a blog up there as well. I've only got one entry so far. But anyway, it's controversialcoach.com. If anybody's interested, please go ahead and take a look. I'd love to get your feedback. Today, we are having a guest that I'm just really, really excited to have on. Her name is Julia Dean. But it's not spelled the way name Dean is normally spelled. Normally that's spelled D-E-A-N, but her name is spelled D-U-I-N, Julia Dean. She is the religion reporter for the Washington Times. And I'm going to put another shameless plug in here. Not only have I been reading Julia's columns for years, but the Washington Times is a fantastic newspaper. It has a conservative editorial page, but whatever your political leanings are, it's a very fair paper. And it's my favorite paper. It's something I can't get by without reading every morning. So anybody who wants to have a good source of information about current events, definitely check out the Washington Times. Julia Dean is the religion reporter for the Washington Times. She actually, I think, is the religion editor for the paper. She has written four books, and her latest book is a book that I'm very excited to discuss. It's called Quitting Church, Why the Faithful Are Leaving in Droves and What to Do About It. Julia, welcome to The Cosmic Citizen.
Thank you.
Julia, let me first of all, this is a very interesting book, and it relates to us as Urantia book readers, which I will share at some point during the show. But, you know, this book about why people are quitting church, the thing I think thought was most interesting about this was that you didn't write this from the perspective of a sociologist or a statistician. I mean, you did talk about demographic trends and things like that, but this is a very personal experience for you. You've spent quite a few decades in the church, haven't you?
Right. I mean, I grew up in the Jesus movement and the charismatic renewal and sort of went toward charismatic Episcopal churches. And I was fine with that. And then I was going to a church in Northern Virginia, which had some, shall we say, real problems. And about 400 of us over a period of a few years left there, so it wasn't just me. And I began waking up to problems out there in terms of decent churches when I was looking for a replacement church. Now, Northern Virginia is pretty much like the top rung of the Washington, D.C. area. Fairfax County is one of the richest U.S. counties. There's some really smart people in Northern Virginia. So you'd think that the churches would be pretty good. And I've been a born-again Christian for about 35 years. So I've kind of been there, done that on just about everything, you know, read the books, done the seminars, everything. And so I kind of had heard it all and had gone to, say, as a reporter, had visited some of the revivals in Canada and Pensacola. And so I've documented and reported on an awful lot of stuff. I mean, even going to some of the Catholic, Virgin Mary appearing in Medjugorje, and I mean, you name it. I've kind of been there. So I know that maybe my tastes might be a tad more sophisticated than a few other people's. But like I say, people in Northern Virginia aren't dumb. And after I left my churches, I was going around visiting various places. I was amazed to find how many churches were so dumbed down. They were what I call seeker-friendly, purpose-driven, or whatever the slogan of the day is. Seeker-friendly churches, for those of you who aren't too familiar with that, it's kind of almost a movement that came in the 80s that we were going to make our churches really friendly. We want to make them evangelistic and friendly to the people so they'll want to come in and become Christians. So what was thought to be sort of complex stuff was all taken out. Services were shortened to about 1 hour and 15 minutes, which was quite different if you were used to those 1970s, 3-hour type services that we all used to have. And then also people were really into the whole purpose-driven church thing. Like we've got to follow this 40 steps on how to make church happen. And I thought, if we're having to follow how-to stuff, this shows that there's anything but revival in life going on in these churches. I mean, if they're having to, paint by the dots, shall we say. So I was just amazed at just the gruel, spiritual porridge that was being offered. And I thought, oh, there's lawyers, there's Supreme Court justices, there's journalists, and all these churches. And I was amazed at what people were putting up with. And then I was discovering a community of people who weren't in church at all. And several of them were people like me who are like reporters and producers who just had it and weren't learning anything and felt like, they were just so overtaxed as it was and they could really use the 3 hours on a Sunday morning. And if church was life-giving, they'd be there, but they were finding it was less and less life-giving. I myself just couldn't find anything, and I really ranged all over the D.C. area. I couldn't find anything that really met several basic requirements. And so I dropped out of church for about five, six years, and only really came back in because I adopted a little girl, and I thought, I've got to get her into something that looks like Sunday school. And so I'm sort of reluctantly back in. And anyway, it turns out I wrote a book about it.
Yeah. Julia,
Julia, before we go on, Andre, some people on the board are saying that Julia is a little hard to hear.
Yeah, I'm having a real hard time hearing you too, Julia. If you could, I don't know what you can do except maybe speak, really, really, really directly into the phone. I don't know if you're, it is a little hard to hear you.
Okay, can you hear me now?
I think so.
I think it's a little
better. Okay, Julia, one other thing, and by the way, speaking of people on the board, I want to make sure that I give out our call-in number as soon as possible here. Our call-in number is 646-716-8158. That's 646-716-8158. I know you can see that on the screen, but talk radio is about repetition, so the more I tell you, the better. Anyway, Julia, one of the things that I find frustrating, and I spent many years as a born-again Christian as well, and I still consider myself a Christian, though I've definitely departed from what most Christians would consider orthodoxy. But what frustrated me is whenever I would complain about these things, and voice these concerns, people would just say, "Oh, you just want a perfect church. That's your, that's your problem. You shouldn't, and that kind of thing." I mean, do you hear a lot of that kind of attitude from people that they just don't want to hear what you have to say?
Absolutely. In fact, one of the criticisms that I've gotten from this book is like, "Oh, she's just a dilettante Christian." And it's like, no, guys, there is a real problem out there. And that's one of the things I wanted to do with this book is to point out there is a problem and make it really clear that there is a problem. Some folks have said, well, you need to point out what to do after people leave church. I said, no, first of all, I've got to persuade a whole ton of people that there's something very wrong with the evangelical church today. So, yes, it's always put back on you. Oh, it's your fault. You're the backslider. You're the complainer. You're the do-nothing person. And if you would only volunteer a little bit more or give a bit more, then everything would be better. And, again, after 25, 30 years in this, I saw that was not the case.
Well, that's just
This is where I love to add, because I have seen this trend so many times when people dare to question anything about their faith, then their own faith falls into question. And I like to point out, especially to Christians, that Jesus himself gave us permission to seek, ask, and knock. And he said, if we will only do that, if we will only take that initiative, that the answer is coming. You know, the door is opening, and we will find what we're seeking for. We have every right to search spiritually. In fact, Jesus again said, you know, blessed are the hungry, for they shall be fed. But if you're hungry, you have to look for sustenance, you know. And so I always find this interesting when, you know, it's your fault if you're not finding, you know, something satisfying, and it's because you're lacking. You don't have enough faith, or, you know, just it's troublesome to me.
Yeah, well, and the thing is, Julianne, let me just say this too. You mentioned the seeker-friendly churches, and I understand. And see, to me, that's good in theory. I mean, I love the idea. I mean, you know, I think, you know, I mean, Paul does this in the book of Acts in chapter 7, you know, Acts 17. He talks to the Athenians on Mars Hill, and he talks to them, you know, he uses their own pagan philosophy to point them to Jesus Christ. I mean, I think that all that stuff is great. But the problem I have with a lot of the seeker-friendly churches is, as you said, I don't know how seeker-friendly they really are. I guess that's part of what concerns me is that I'm not sure if they're really addressing the questions that people have. It's almost like they just have a formula they want to follow.
Right, right. And a lot of people, they're scared of questions. And the big thing that really, really got to me is that before this five-year period, when I just walked out, there was a lot of things just going on in my personal life, many questions. Prayers that God wasn't answering, and people would say to me, oh, you just think God isn't answering your prayers. You know, I hated that. I hated this second guessing, this, oh, you don't really know what's going on in your own life. You just think God is really there. But, and I would say, no, wait a minute, he is not answering it. And I would say he didn't answer X, A, B, C, D, and E, and I would tick off certain things. Oh, you just think he's not answering it. So it was these false answers to real questions, and I found other people who were having some real suffering going on in their lives and getting nothing back, no help whatsoever. And that really got to me after a while. I would go to, like, the pastors of my church and say, can you do something? I don't answer prayer. You have a whole series on prayer. You're just assuming God's answering prayer. Well, look, and like, there's 500 of us here, or 800, or it was 800 at one point. I would say, God, I'm sorry, guys. But God's not answering prayers. He's not healing these people. And why can't you face it? And let's deal with that. They wouldn't do it. It was just all this denial was really getting to me. And that was another reason I just thought, who needs this? I'm not going to give money to this. And so they say people who are unhappy with church, the first thing they do is remove their labor. And that's exactly what I did. I just stopped volunteering for stuff. No one's going to notice. And then the second thing people do, remove their money. Sure enough, I just my tithes went somewhere else. And then afterwards, they just removed themselves, and I stayed out of there for a couple months, and again, no one seemed to notice, so I was out the door.
Yeah. The other thing that really frustrates me, too, Julia, is when people, you know, we talked about people putting the onus back on you and saying, well, it's your fault. The other thing that drives me nuts is when I hear people say, well, you shouldn't go to church to get your needs met. Oh, that just drives me crazy. I heard that so often from people. You know, well, if my needs don't matter, then I guess it doesn't matter where I go to church. I could go to the dullest church in the world because I'm supposed to just be there to serve. Well, you know, if I'm not being equipped to serve, then, you know, what difference does it make where I go?
That's ridiculous. I mean, yeah, I totally agree, because look at Jesus. I mean, he met people's needs.
Of course.
I mean, he was feeding them. He was healing them. Doggone right. I mean, do you think he would have gotten beyond, you know, point two if he had said, hey, guys, I don't feel like healing you today. Hey, you're here just to get your needs met, and I'm not here for that. I mean, he did try to teach and call people to repentance. I mean, I think he got a bit frustrated because folks did seem to be there for free handouts and for healing. I mean, they were the same as we were 2,000 years ago, but a lot more desperate. So, yeah, but he still met people's needs. But you're right. You get these, like, pseudo-spiritual answers. Oh, you know, you're here to give and not to receive. Well, right now, especially, I'm now, once I've adopted a little person, I'm a single mom who works full-time, and doggone it, I've got needs. And I'm what people, church professionals, rather dismissively call a feeder. I go in, I absorb, I take, and I don't give much. But that's okay, because In my 20s and 30s, I was on 5 billion committees. I was at the church for, say, 3 nights a week, and I gave a lot. And there are seasons where you do and you do not give. No one's complaining about that necessarily, but it's just the whole thing of, oh, you can't get there to get your needs met. And you know what? I've got to say this about John Osteen, who's that megachurch pastor in Houston, and I have a lot of differences with Mr. Osteen on just many, many things, but one thing he's got right is he knows that people have come there with needs, and he's going to try to meet them. He might not meet them financially. In fact, it seems like he's more asking for money than giving it away, but he's at least trying to meet them emotionally and trying to get people out, walking out there feeling better than when they walked in.
Wow. Hmm. Wow. Well, again, we are speaking with Julia Dean, who is religion editor for the Washington Times. Her book is Quitting Church, Why the Faithful Are Leaving in Droves and What to Do About It. Maybe some of you out there, I think I'm pretty sure some of you out there have been frustrated with churches. Maybe you've got some concerns you'd like to share with us. Please give us a call, 646-716-8158. And speaking of people of our particular audience, Julia, and I know you don't know this because you're not familiar with the Urantia book and the kind of people that are attracted to it, but let me just give you a little brief here. The Urantia book is a book that we believe claims to be a revelation from angels and other superhuman beings, and a lot of the people who are attracted to it are people who are really dissatisfied with organized religion. I found that to be true. I'm gonna speak to sort of an opposite trend here. I find among Urantia book readers, there are some people that I think are they bash the church too much. There are some people I know who just hate church. They just rant and rave against the church. They just don't like. Have you found that to be true too? Do you find that there are some people who have sort of an irrational prejudice toward the church?
Oh yeah, there are some, and especially when I would say kind of the newly resurgent atheist agnostic community, I do get some of that. But and some of it is unreasonable, I agree. But you know what? I think a lot of folks have just been so disappointed, so let down.
Yeah.
Especially like Roman Catholics, you know, who've encountered some of the scandals. I mean, people are just disappointed, and sure, they are bitter. And yeah, I do run into some of that. Not as much as you think, though.
Interesting. I want to talk a little bit about some specific things that you talk about in the book, some specific problems that you address. The chapter that made me the angriest in the book was the chapter that dealt with singles, and we talked about this off the air. I don't think some of our audience, a good part of our audience, are not familiar with how evangelical and conservative churches in particular treat singles. Give them a taste of what it's like, because basically, correct me if I'm wrong, they almost make you feel ashamed if you want to be married. Well, I shouldn't say almost, they really do. They make you feel that there's shame, they put people on guilt trips. If they want to be married.
This is really shocking to me, Andrea. I mean, it's just amazing to me because I have always heard that the best place to go to meet a nice single person is at a church. I mean, where do you meet nice people? At bars?
Actually, a lot of single women, I mean, the newest thing out on with single, at least single Christian women, is that, no, you do not meet men in churches because men aren't in church anymore. It used to be, sure, that's where you'd meet a nice single guy. No more. And a lot of us are asking, well, where are they? And in fact, I asked a single Christian guy, I did find one at one point, I said, where do you hang out? I mean, I've been to the gym. There's no, the guys at the gym, I would not call them evangelical Christians by a long shot. There's something else entirely. And are you at the beach? Are you surfing? He didn't really have an answer. But anyway, what opens up this chapter on singles is a sermon I heard when I was finishing my edits for the book of this pastor who was talking about, this pastor who was saying, hey, I know a lot of you would like to be having sex and it can be wonderful, but it's just something that, it's here 1 minute and gone the next, and, Jesus meets all our needs. He was going on like that. Of course, I was sitting there. I was so mad I could hardly see straight because he said, here he was a man who had 5 kids. All 5 of them were married and married quite young. And so he was telling us how, oh, yeah, singleness is fine and you can do without sexual intimacy and God can meet all those needs, even the sexual ones apparently. And in his own life, he had done anything but follow that. And it was okay for all those celibate singles out there to, do without, but not his family, and not him. And that, I just sort of, that did it. And I rewrote the chapter to include that because I thought you guys need to understand what's out there and the rather informal cruelty that's there. Then on Labor Day weekend, I went on a singles retreat with another church I mentioned in this chapter. This is just, about a month ago. And the singles there were just furious because there's a lot of them in that church, and they have no staff. And this is a mega church they all went to, and this particular mega church spent lots of money on its under 35 singles group, many, many staff members, like 9 or 10. But over 35, nope, the only volunteers run that group, and which is just ridiculous. So it's just the typical church only concentrates on younger singles. The older ones are basically sent out, they're farmed out. No one cares about them. Well, there's 86 million singles at least in this country. In fact, I heard that might be out of date. It's more like 100 million singles. That's one-third of the population. That's enormous. We're talking people over 18. So here is a demographic that any organization should be going for. I think the Democratic Party is very interested in this demographic, but no one else seems to be, and no one wants them. And the singles, you've heard all the statistics. They have the most money. They have the most time. But does your typical church want them? No.
Well,
no,
they do it. Okay, supposedly they have the most money. Although single moms, I read in your book that a lot of churches don't want to, the pastors don't want to hang out with single moms because they don't give enough money to the church. But the thing is that it's funny you say they don't want them, but in a way they do want them, but they just want them as labor fodder. They just want them to do the grunt work in the church.
Right.
That's what they want them for. They don't want them as people. They want them, they want them as workhorses. Now, what I want to kind of focus on again, because I ran into this, and again, Paula, this has been my experience. I don't know how much I share this with you, but I've run into this a lot. If I'm feeling lonely, or if I'm looking for a wife, I'm telling you, people will. A lot of Christians would make me feel like I wasn't spiritual. Well, you need to get closer to God. Well, let me tell you something. I'm not trying to sound arrogant or super spiritual, but I think I have quite a good relationship with God. I've practiced something called listening prayer, where I listen to what God has to say to me, and I write it down in a journal. But that doesn't make my need for a spouse go away. God hasn't taken that need. If God is calling me to be single, then I say to God, if you want me to be single, then take the desire away from me, to want a wife and to want a spouse. And I also want to take this opportunity to do something I normally don't do. And Julia, you didn't talk about this so much in your book. You mentioned it a little bit. But I wish, what really bothers me too, and I understand there are churches that hold to a biblical paradigm about sex, and they they don't believe in sex until marriage, and that's fine. In fact, frankly, for the audience out there that doesn't know this, I'm actually 38 years old, and I'm still a virgin, and I'd like to wait until marriage. Now, the Urantia book doesn't teach that, but I personally would like to do that because I'm a hopeless romantic, and I want my wife to know she's special, okay?
Right.
But the thing is this. Here's what bothers me. There is a lot of legalism about sex in the church. And when I say legalism, I mean there are people – I'll give you an example. I was talking to one guy who was an ex-homosexual or claimed to be an ex-homosexual, okay? And he said that God healed him of his homosexuality, which is fine. It's fine and dandy. If that's how he feels, that's great. But I told him the kind of woman I was interested in. And basically – and again, the audience doesn't know this, but I will tell everybody this. I am very, very, very attracted to large, heavy-set ladies. In fact, they're really the only women I like. it all has to do with an experience I had as a child when I was a little boy. There was a woman my mom knew, and I was sitting in her lap, and I was very comforted by her. And this is getting pretty personal, but I'll just go ahead and say it. She had extremely large hands, which is kind of rare for a woman. But ever since that day, I've had this attraction to large women, and I had this particular attraction to women who have extremely large hands. And, I was told by this person, well, you've got a fetish. You need help. You need to go get therapy and all this other stuff. I know this may sound a little odd, Julia, but why couldn't the guy have just said to me, well, gee, maybe I'll see if I can find somebody who fits that profile. What is so wrong about sharing these kinds of things and talking about them frankly without shame?
I have to interject something here. I think, Andre and Julia, what you guys are talking about is such a primal and such a basic human need the human need for companionship, for somebody meaningful in your life, for somebody to share your thoughts and dreams and hopes and aspirations. And everybody has the right to choose what that person should be like, if they want that person to share their faith, if they want that person to have large hands. I mean, the fact that you're blind, Andre, that makes me see why you would be attracted to a person like that, because you are honing in primarily on your sense of feel. And I think, you know, the church and what you've said, Julia, is two things to me so far that the church is ignoring. One is a basic need to feel like God is hearing you, listening to you, and caring about you, and answering your prayers. And what does that mean? People are looking for answers that make sense about God, okay? And they're looking to their clergy. Maybe they're not looking in the right place, but you know, it's one of those things where else would you look? And the other thing that you've both communicated is the fact that you're looking for somebody meaningful in your life, and you're going to the most meaningful place you can think of to find that person. And I think that makes complete sense. But here are two places that we've just identified where the church is falling short. For whatever reason, they're not addressing these basic human needs. And why should somebody keep investing in something that isn't doing that?
Well, that's exactly what you say in the book, Julia. Too many people say, why should I keep investing if I don't get a return? But I want to just go back just for a second and let you answer this, Julia. What is the did you find that there was a real rigidity when it came to talking about sex?
Yes, and this I ran into more in the first. I wrote a book back in 1986 on sexual purity for singles, and I was quite a bit younger, obviously, like 20 years younger, 22 years younger. And so I was, and back then also too, no one was talking about sex and singles in the church. Now, years later, there's lots of books out, but there wasn't much in 86, 87, 88 when I was coming out with something. And my goodness, it was hard to get anybody to talk. You just, everybody was just so, what's the word? Uptight's not the right word, but I thought, now this is stupid. Here is a church that preaches abstinence, and you know, we women have women's needs, men have men's needs. There should be places we can go and actually talk about this stuff. And I was writing a book, for heaven's sakes, and I found it very hard to get friends, married, single, whatever, to talk about, you know, the real sexual needs. Everybody was just afraid, like it would open some sort of waterfall or something if they dared mention these things. It was unbelievably frustrating, and I really ran into this 20 years ago. I wouldn't say it's a whole lot better now at all. In fact, in one of the terms I use in Chapter 5 is the term eunuch makers. It's
yes.
What you would especially conservative churches do. They just these mind games that they do with singles that you're always given to understand that, especially, again, once you're over 35, oh, my gosh, hey, you're not married yet. God must not mean for you to get married. Never mind that, you know, there might be really good reasons, like there's for us women, that is why there are no men within 40 miles or, you know, certain denominations just don't have a whole lot of men in them. I mean, churches, as we all know, and especially if you're Black or Hispanic, my gosh, it's really tough to find men who are decent. So, anyway,
Julia,
do
you think this is the church's way of avoiding a problem that they really don't have any clue how to deal with?
You're right. Well, I think they have no clue. But you know what? If people spent enough time and actually doing the research, they might have a clue. I find, for instance, like this is, again, singles ministry. How many people do you know are trained in singles ministry? They're trained in youth ministry, but not in singles ministry.
That's
you can't
a good
even
point.
Find a good magazine out there that deals with singles ministry. Churches put their money toward young people, the under 18 cohort, which is okay. I mean, people do need to hear the gospel when they are children. That is true. But to just basically then ignore them and some of these really deep questions, really, really stupid. Again, there's more stuff on there, like Lauren Winter, for instance, and some other writers have actually written a theology of either modesty or Christian sex, and what is it and what does it look like. And there's the books on singleness basically fall into two categories. One is, like I call, the stiff upper lip category. that, again, is just really into denial, and you can do it, and doesn't go through it. Singles really do. And there's maybe a handful of others. In fact, I'm not really aware of many others at all that actually are quite frank about your needs as a single and what you do about it, especially, again, as you're going into your 30s, way longer than you thought you'd ever wait for being a married person.
Hmm. I want. There's so many directions we can take this conversation because your book is, it goes in so many directions. But I want to talk a little about people who really have just given up on the church. Well, it's interesting because I found that there were two categories of people first of all, the people who are leaving church, they're not all people who've given up on the faith. I one of the things I think is very important to understand is people are quitting church, but they're not necessarily quitting God. In fact, a lot of people are not quitting God. Some of the people who are leaving church are leaving church because they're very serious students of the Bible. They're conservative Christians, and they felt like they were just getting nothing but pablum, as you said, at the churches. There also are people like this guy in your book, and I hope you don't mind mentioning his name, because you mentioned in the book a guy named Dan Bailey, for example, that you wrote about.
Actually, his real name is David. I got to run a correction. Yeah, David Bailey.
Okay.
What it is.
Well, he was a former pastor.
Right.
And he actually started doubting some things in the Bible. And started, you know, and let me ask you, how much of that did you run into? Did you also run into people who said, well, maybe the Bible is part of the problem? You know, maybe the orthodox assumptions I've held to are part of the problem. Did you run into a lot of people like that as well?
I ran into some of it. Again, David was one of these guys, and he said, you know, there's nowhere where you can ask real questions. Actually, the only place I know where you really can ask real questions, if you've heard of LaBrie, which is the outfit that was founded by Francis Schaeffer, where people do go and ask serious questions about their faith, because they're coming up with questions no one can answer. But other than that, no, there's not much out there for people who are having, I hate to say midlife crises, it's not quite the right word, who are having faith crises, which we all have, by the way.
Yes, absolutely.
And if you don't get decent answers, you know, you're just going to start drifting in another direction. I mean, you might go where the two of you have kind of gone, or you might just go somewhere else, or you might go nowhere. Because you just think, look, intellectually, if Christianity cannot hold its own against my questions, it is not worth sticking with us. It was nice for a time, but I'm out of here. Well, I mean, I think there are answers to these questions. I really do. And I try to point people towards some of the better authors that I have found, but boy, I'd say 80% of what's out there is pretty bad.
Well, yeah, even though I'm no longer an evangelical, there are some authors I respect. One that some of you listeners might be interested in is a guy named Ravi Zacharias, who I think is an excellent writer,
right,
and an excellent speaker. You know, I don't hold to his theology anymore, but for someone who is an Orthodox Christian theologian, I think he does a great job. But you know, one of the things that I guess one of the things I want to share with you, Julia, is in our Urantia book, there is a paper. The book is divided into papers, and there's a paper in there on the kingdom of God. And one of the things it says in there is it says the Christian church is the cocoon in which the kingdom of God now slumbers. And
the religion of Jesus, Andre. It's the cocoon in which the religion of Jesus slumber.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought it says the kingdom of God. Okay.
No, the religion of Jesus, which is different. It makes a clear distinction between the religion of Jesus and the religion about Jesus.
Okay. So the religion of Jesus versus Christianity. Okay. Well, the basic point that I think is that I want to make here is that the book sort of essentially says that, you know, that right now the religion of Jesus is slumbering, okay? And that basically, there needs to be an opportunity for a real brotherhood of spirit believers to emerge. And I guess what I want to say is, when I was reading your book, on the one hand, it's depressing, but on the other hand, to me, I love it. I think it's great in a way that the church is imploding the way it is, because I think it's a great opportunity for an overhaul in the system. I mean, you talk in your book about people who are having house churches, who are meeting informally, who are, you know, finding alternative kind of forms of community. Did you find that? Did you ever run into some people who said, "This is great. This is a real opportunity for the Holy Spirit to be released from his confinement in the church box"? I mean, did you run into any people who?
Yeah, I ran into a number of people who just feel that, yeah, the system is totally broken, and especially since a number of us
some 30 years ago who lived through the 70s and who really saw church as it should be, in more of a revival mode. I mean, I really, the Jesus movement, charismatic renewal, that whole, the 70s, and I lived in one, like a Christian commune for a while. So, I mean, I really got into it. And, I mean, it was an exciting time. There were a lot of mistakes made, but boy, yeah, a lot of mistakes. But it was a time, I mean, that makes now look so dull and so gray compared to what we did back then. Yeah, I think there's a fair amount of people who are saying this is really needed. They're not calling it a second reformation or anything, but they say what's needed is a real rethinking of church. And these are the folks who are saying that mega churches aren't going to be around forever, these kind of warehouses type churches. Or, you know, a lot of people are just going to gravitate toward meeting in the home, especially if times get very hard, if there's any kind of persecution, which I can't imagine in this country anytime soon. But I'm getting a lot of people, yeah, who just say, you know what, we just cannot do the system anymore, and we're reinventing things. I've got a phone call from some folks who are about 20 miles away from me, and they want to meet with me, and just say, okay, we got to know where we go from now. We've got people meeting in our home. We've got all these kids, and we want to reinvent this thing. We're not too sure how to do it, but we want to totally rethink this. So, yes, in a way, it is the best of times. It's not necessarily a dead end for the body of Christ.
Mm. Mm. You were, yeah, I definitely would agree with that. I mean, I think I definitely support. Let me. You were talking about Christian communes in the 70s, and Paula, you've mentioned to me too that in the Urantia movement there was more of that communal atmosphere in the 70s too. People would stay at people's homes. There was, you know, I don't know what was different about that time than it is today. But Julia, do you see any hope for a revival of that kind of thing? That kind of. Do you think the house church movement might lead to something like that?
You know, I really hope so. I think a lot of us who were in it back then are just dying for something to happen. It's so boring today what's going on in American Christianity. We're just dying of, we're slumbering here. And I don't know what would lead to it. In fact, I'm coming out with a book next year that has to do with the charismatic movement and warning people of the bad and the good, just so some of the bad stuff doesn't get repeated. But my goodness, I'd really like to go back to some of the things we had in that era. It was so exciting, and everybody was hospitable, and you had people over at the home all the time, and so much stuff was going on, and people were converting left and right, and the preaching was better, and everything was just so fresh. And it wasn't because some of us were new in the faith, although I was new, very new at that time, but it was just that so much was going on. There's so much in every church. The Washington, D.C. area was alive with prayer meetings and everything, and it's so different than it is today. And people were, you just heard of people becoming Christians all the time. So I hope that somehow, I don't know if it's the house church movement, I don't know what, I think the desperation, you know what, I see there's so much desperation out there. I don't know if you've heard of some of the recent pseudo-revivals that have gone on. There's this guy in Lakeland, Florida, who's claiming to heal people. That was from like April through the beginning of August. What a mess. And then it was he suddenly left because he was basically getting a divorce or separation from his wife. Apparently he had more crud in his background than anybody knew. But he was strong. People from around the world were just swarming to his crusades. And something similar happened in Pensacola back in like 97, 98, 95 through 98. Nightly revivals. I mean, people are just dying for something, anything. And so, yeah, there's this desperation out there just kind of to reinvent what happened 30 years ago.
Wow.
Don't you think that, in a way, the Urantia book really spells out that there has been what has grown up in Christianity is a religion about Jesus. And in a sense, what's missing is the religion of Jesus, that Jesus has been buried in 2,000 years of dogma and theology and doctrine. And his real spirit, his spirit of love, his spirit of truth, his spirit of forgiveness, his spirit of tolerance, his spirit of joy, his spirit of faith, everything that he represented for our world, which was not the Jewish faith, not the Christian faith, no, something much, much more than that, a universal faith, a faith of, you know, if ever there was an ambassador on this world from the heavenly realms, Jesus is that person, and he showed for us something more than just a religion of mind. and a theology of tradition and dogma. He showed us a dynamic living faith, a courage that's transcendental. And in a sense, from what I understand about the Urantia book, and one of the reasons I love it, is it really illuminates that. And it says that, you know, Christianity would really do a transcendent service for the world if only it would resurrect Jesus from the tomb of theological traditions and show him forth as the living Christ, the inspiration for now and for all ages. And I think that's, you know, in a sense, that's what I hear you saying is the church feels like it's dying in a sense, like, but I think it's true, it is, because it's lost him. It's got caught up in its own theology about him, and it's lost him, and it needs to revive him and get him back and quit judging, quit the pitiful subdivisions and the judgments about people of other faith traditions and the belief that God likes me best. And in all of these things that kind of, they're not of Jesus' spirit. They're just something that we've manufactured.
As you know, I can't speak to the Urantia book because I haven't read it. And this is
my first
time that I've really encountered people who do believe in it. I do know that the one thing about Jesus is that he was pretty clear that he was the only way. And so, he wasn't necessarily saying that anyone else, there was any other way to heaven besides him. So in terms of other religious traditions, he would not say as accepted Muhammad being the last prophet or Baha'u'llah or any of the others. However, I think a lot of Christians are asking the same questions you are. They're saying, like, wait a minute, what is going on? We're, for instance, like Southern Baptists, which are one of the more evangelical groups in the country, and their baptisms are falling. They're saying, okay, what is going on? I mean, we have one of the freest countries in the world in terms of spreading the gospel, and people don't want it. Why not? Why are our numbers falling? This is just bizarre. And other groups that are growing, for instance, like the Roman Catholic Church, it's only because of Hispanic immigration, and they're admitting as much. The Assemblies of God, they're a Pentecostal group, and they are also slowly growing. Other groups that are growing, interestingly enough, although there's lots of questions as to how much that growth is happening, is the Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses. And you know, why is it sort of the more unusual religions are growing?
Oh, I think I can give you an answer to that. I mean, I think that one of the reasons that Jehovah's Witnesses and the Mormons are growing, and I know that traditional Christians look at those groups as cults, but I think the reason they're growing is because they're meeting needs that the traditional church isn't meeting. I mean, these people, you know, if you are involved in Jehovah's Witnesses or Mormons, I mean, they treat you like family. You know, they the Jehovah's Witnesses, unfortunately, have a lot of, there's a lot of judgment there. They'll excommunicate you if you smoke or whatever. I mean, there are things that, you know, they do have some problems. The point I'm making, though, is that I think a lot of these movements are creating the kind of community we're talking about. I mean, you talk in your book about how the Mormon kids, you know, they go on mission trips, and to prepare for that, they, you know, get up on Sunday morning at six in the morning and study the Bible and study the Book of Mormon. I mean, these are committed people, and they're modeling that. You know, they're modeling that kind of devotion.
Well, one of the things that I can say about Mormonism that was attractive to me as a young mother was their tremendous support of families. But there again, you know, and they're for single people, what you mentioned earlier, I can't see that they would have a whole lot going on there for single people. They're tremendously supportive of families, though. And if you're a member of the Mormon Church and you fall upon hard times, you need not worry at all because you will be cared for. They will rally around you and care for you. And I think that's something that's very attractive to people, especially in this uncertain world that we're living in. And Jehovah's Witnesses, I think, you know, they claim to have the truth, and they're making some very bold statements. But in my own personal experience, because I did study with them. I had to reject them about 6 months in because much of what they were telling me totally did not set well within my heart or within my spirit. It grinded against my natural beliefs. And I was early on taught that you have an ability to recognize truth, and if it grinds against you, you don't have to accept it as being true. And I think that, Julie, as I've read your book, as much as I've read of it, I sense a frustration from the people that you've interviewed that a couple of things you said, that much of the church services are just like gruel. They have no substance. People are ready for more. Maybe that worked up to a certain point, but it's just like babies and baby food. You can't keep feeding a child baby food until they're 18 years old. As they grow up, they need more. They need more substance. Baby food doesn't cut it anymore. And so that's kind of what reading between the lines or the undercurrent of the people you interviewed and the things that they had to say. There was a couple of patterns that came forth. They're bored. Why should I invest 2 hours on a Sunday when I'm not getting what I need? You know, various needs, basic needs that weren't being met, like you mentioned, single and the need to be with other people, you know, other single people of the opposite sex who might fulfill that, or there might be an opportunity for marriage or a meaningful relationship in that. There's basic needs that aren't being met, but this idea of boredom was very intriguing to me. Because, and then you mentioned a book somebody had written, Why Men Are Leaving. You know, and my own dad wouldn't go to church. He found it just unbearably boring. And yet my dad was one of the most spiritual guys I've ever met. He had a heart of gold. Right. So I think this is, you know, these are all key to what, you know, what is spiritual? Like, what do we want from spirituality? I think if we could get a handle on what we want a church to do for us and what you just said, you know, getting together with your friends and saying, we don't know where to go from here, but we want to try. I think the first step would be to say, what is it we really want? What is it we really need?
Well, one thing, here's something else, is a lot of churches are not doing a good job at teaching people how to hear from God. Now, that sounds really basic. You would think that that is something that you would get pretty much as a new Christian. How do you hear God speak to you? Well, and I've had more people say, I don't know what God's voice feels like. What does it sound like? Mm-hmm. Well, sure, I know it took me a lot of trial and error to kind of figure out what was God speaking to me, what wasn't, when it wasn't him, when it was. I mean, it just took several years, and I'm still not perfect at it yet, but I think I've got an idea. And, you know, sometimes when you just don't feel at peace about something, or, you know, sometimes it's very, very subtle. But this is really basic. People need to know the voice of God for themselves. And they need to learn several things, how to study the Bible, there's a bunch, but hearing God. And this is one thing, for instance, is just never taught. When's the last time you really got something that you could learn from on how to hear God's voice for yourself? And you know why? I think a lot of times, a number of pastors, they don't want people kind of going off and hearing God for themselves. They're scared of what these people might hear.
Well, yeah, I agree with you. Because, you know, one of the things that I find is that a lot of times, and it kind of going back to what we're talking about with people putting people on guilt trips because they're single or because they want to be married, you know, one of the things I was talking to a friend of mine last night about is one thing he's struggling with is how to tell the difference between false guilt and what Christians would call the conviction of the Holy Spirit.
Right.
Because there are a lot of people who will put people on guilt trips, and I call it they try to play the Holy Spirit in people's lives. You know, they try to tell them, you should do this, you should do that, and, you know, God is telling me to tell, you know, It was like the one guy you told me about. You mentioned in your book, Julia, who said he tried a dating service and it didn't work. And the leader of his small group said, "Well, that's because God didn't want it to work for you. God wants you to be single." Well, who is this guy to know? I mean, the nerve that some people have. But the thing that's interesting to me, I want to go back to the thing about unanswered prayer, Because and I believe me, I do not want to minimize how people feel that their prayers haven't been answered. And Jesus does tell us to ask God to get our needs met, just like little children ask their daddy for bread and milk and things like that. Having said that, though, I think part of the problem is that I think a lot of people don't understand the purpose of prayer. I mean, I think the purpose of prayer really, ultimately, is just to get closer to God. It's not about, you know, getting this or that. It, you know, the point is, if you get closer to God, if you're bonding more deeply with God, then to me that to me is the evidence of a successful prayer life. Not, you know, that I got this or I got that. And again, I'm not saying we shouldn't ask for those things. You know, I don't want to go to the other extreme and say, well, you know, some people say you shouldn't treat God like a vending machine. No, you shouldn't. But on the other hand, there's nothing wrong with asking God. But again, I think people, a lot of people are missing what the purpose of prayer really is.
You know, I think too, Andre, and sometimes the answer is just too obvious, and I don't know if you've experienced this, Julia, but sometimes the answer to our prayer is just too obvious, and we miss it. We tend to overcomplicate things as a race of humans on the planet. I think we just tend to do that. We think that it has to be very complex, and really it's not. It's very simple and basic. And for me, you know, prayer, the answer to prayers comes as an insight or a metaphor oftentimes, where I see something and I see the meaning in that and all of a sudden, oh, there's my answer, I got it, okay, I got it. But also, very, very often, when I'm in dire need and I pray, the Heavenly Father sends me another human who is also connected through him, and that human answers my prayer and helps me with my need. And it's a very personal and real response, because we humans can touch each other and hold each other and hear each other and be with one another. And so God bridges the gap using us. If we are willing to do his work, he will use those of us, because he lives in all of his children. He will use us to answer prayers for each other. And so often when I'm down, or when I'm praying and I'm saying, oh, Father, I can't take it today. I just am down. Some loving person will call me and say, you know, Paula, I just got this feeling I needed to call you. And I have come to know that is such a faithful and practical, you mean, I can have total faith in that, because that is the way God so often answers prayers, is with other human beings who are willing to respond to God's leading.
Well, and there's some of that, yeah, but there's also real prayers that just don't get answered at all. And I'm not counting the ones that can get answered. I'm counting stuff that, some of the really heavy stuff, the please, you know, heal this person, or help me find a spouse, or help us conceive a child. I mean, really, prayers that definitely have an answer or not an answer. And those are the ones that, you know, are real deep requests that, you know, when you don't get those answered in a yes, you just like, why? And you need people to help you through that.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah,
exactly.
And,
you do. I agree.
And intellectually, we know that Jesus didn't heal everybody. You know, we know that. But I think I think there are a couple of things that are going on. One is that people need comfort. They don't just need
yes.
intellectual answers. And you know, they do need that, though. Yes, you're right. And I think that part of the problem is that the church is not comfortable with doubt. A lot of church leaders are not comfortable with real doubts. They say they are, but, you know, when you start doubting and asking questions and doubting and going through a time where you're doubting your faith, then they'll start wondering, well, are you really saved, or whatever, you know. The other thing, though, I think that it goes on is that you mentioned something about healing a child, and I don't remember what I was going to say, but I'm just saying that I think people need comfort as well as intellectual answers.
They really, you know, I think of a good friend of mine whose husband died, and just what you said, Julia. You know, he was her world. They never had any children. He was everything to her. And at one point, she said to me, she said, you know, Paul, I've knocked until my knuckles are bloody, and it just isn't doing any good.
Well, we're good at rejoicing with those who rejoice, but not mourning with those who mourn.
Yes, exactly.
Right, and understanding them.
And that poor
right.
woman, really, I mean, she needs to be with some other people whose prayers didn't get, you know, there must be like other widows or just
just sometimes, you know, in a way there's not an answer. You don't know why certain horrible things happen. Sometimes you just will not get an answer. But doggone it, someone in my church, please just acknowledge that there's not an answer. Don't blame me. Don't say, oh, it's your fault or it's your lack of faith or God's talking to you. You're just not listening to him. I mean, again, it's the blame the victim stuff that it just drives people.
We don't have too much time left here, Julie, but I want to just say one thing. I think the other thing, and again, I don't mean to be insensitive to what people are going through because I think you're absolutely correct. I think, though, sometimes, though, that people believe that God is going to do things that he hasn't promised to do. God doesn't say that he's going to heal every person, or God doesn't say he's going to, you know. Now, that does not take away the pain that people go through, though, and I think that's what's most important. And I remember, you know, the one thing I want to get to, too, before we go, and that is that in your book you talk about how the church treats women, and this is really interesting because, as I said off the air to you, there's such a double standard because on the one hand, they tend to make people feel ashamed if they want to be married and they're single. But then if you have a single, independent, strong-minded woman who wants to take some leadership roles in the church, they don't like that either.
No. And so it's those kind of women who really see nothing for them, especially the older they get and they're in more executive roles at their job. And they're used to being able to tell people to come and go. And all they come to church and they find that they're the receptionist or they're doing nursery care. And all the elders are guys who, you know, who would be several steps below them if this were at work. I mean, I understand that church is not exactly the mirror of the workplace. I understand that. But why is it that, you know, the women are always on the second rung when it comes to church? And that just doesn't seem right to me. And so, again, a lot of women are you know what, I can use my talents better. I'll do something with, like, a parachurch organization like Young Life or something where at least my experience is desirable and not people aren't afraid that I'm going to seduce them.
Julie, why do you think this?
I mean, that's something we haven't even gone into, but a lot of women are just treated like they're potential temptresses.
Why do you think that the church is unwilling or afraid, let's say afraid, to examine these things and in a sense reinvent itself to be more current with the 21st century rather than, you know, I mean, what do you think is at the heart of this fear of change? Is it just a basic human thing?
Oh, boy. I think there's a real fear that somehow we'll go theologically off the rails somehow. And so that's why you're seeing a renaissance of what would I call the new reform movement, which is reform theology is something that basically, you know, that wasn't, That's many decades back, and it's all come into whereby that all the, like a lot of the 20, 30 somethings are what I call very reform-minded Christians. It's hard to explain it in a few minutes what that is, but it's much in terms of like any kind of activity by women, especially anything having to do with the charismatic movement. Forget that. I mean, the reform movement, by and large, wants nothing to do with that. It's more having to do with certain doctrines, predestination being one of the more unpopular ones. But I mean, there's some good stuff, and they're usually very good on the whole teaching end. I don't want to downplay that, but my goodness, the whole reform stuff, that's where we were in the 40s and 50s, and we're going back to that?
Yeah.
We should be morphing into something totally different after the Jesus movement, and we're retrenching, and that's a shame.
Yeah. Julia, we're going to have to call it a day here in a second, but I want to, just before we go, I want to just, I guess, well, two things. I want to make sure that people know how to get your book, Quitting Church, which is available, I know, at Barnes & Noble for sure, and I'm assuming other bookstores as well have it. And the name again is Julia Dean, D-U-I-N. It's published by Baker Books. I guess if you had anything to say to people who, you know, who, because I know that a lot of our audience is frustrated with church. A lot of them just don't even bother going anymore. What would you say to them?
Well, I would. There's they say even if you give up on church, don't give up on God. And
oh yeah.
I would really, really stress that. And what I did during my 5 years out, I continued to read the Bible. I studied it quite a bit. In fact, I had to because I wasn't in church, so I needed to make sure I was really out there, you know, reading the stuff, reading the books. I just kept on, you know,
do the reading. There's, if you're into it, like there's a problem with suffering, I thought one of the best authors out there is Bob Sorge. That's S-O-R-G-E. And he's fabulous. That, he just deals with many reasons for suffering. And why is there suffering? In an Orthodox Christian theological context, which I really appreciate it, because he doesn't say, oh, it's not happening. He's not Gnostic about it. He says, yeah, it's happening. And no, God, you're right. God's not answering prayer. But here's why. Here's how to press in. And I would say, yeah, that's a really good message for people who are just despairing about church. I would say press in and ask God to lead you to a good place. But you might be in exile for a while. Like I said, I was out for 5 or 6 years. And sometimes it's okay to take a vacation from church. It's not like you're going to hell. You know, it's especially those of you who are Christians, as long as you make sure you are still one. If you just need to get out for a season, that's fine. And, you know, use that time to, you know, pray, study, and search about more.
But I also would say that if you're away from church for a while, that doesn't have to be a desert period either, because I found that some of my most the deepest times of fellowship I've had with believers were outside of church. So I do want to put in a plug for that possibility, that there are alternative ways to get those needs met. But Julia, thank you so much for being on our show today. I really appreciate it, and I hope that this has enlightened our audience and educated them. And again, if they want to get your book, bookstore should carry it, and it's Quitting Church by Julia Dean, D-U-I-N, and it's published by Baker Books. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks.
Thank you, Julia.
You're welcome.
Okay. I'm going to see if she can...
Hey, it's good talking to you guys.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for taking the time with us today.
Okay, I got to go see if my little girl has destroyed the house, but
Okay. Are we still on the air? We're still on the air. I need you to click off here, but thanks a lot, Julia.
Oh, you're welcome.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Well, Paula, I got to tell you, the only thing I can say to all that is, what an opportunity. What an opportunity we have as your answer book readers to share this new revelation with these frustrated people. I mean, and I don't mean that in any kind of manipulative sense, like, oh, we're going to get them while they're vulnerable. No, I mean, these people are hungry. Didn't you sense that?
Oh, her book is full of it. I mean, really, listeners, I highly recommend her book to get a sense of what it is that's making people leave. And it's the same things that made me leave. It's the same thing that made you pick up the Urantia book, Andre. It's the unanswered question. It's the imponderable that nobody seems to be able to give you a decent answer to. Why is there suffering? I mean, she said it several times, and she's calling it unanswered prayer. But it's the basic question of why am I suffering, and why doesn't God take away my pain? Mm. And that is such a basic human question. And the thing that I think is challenging for us Urantia book readers is this: we've had these questions answered, and it's hard for us to remember what it feels like to have that void.
Yeah, and you know what?
Not...
I'll tell you something, Paula. I'm going to admit something in the air, and I don't want people to get the wrong impression, because I'm not doubting the revelation at all. But there are, when I listen to her, you know, she believes that the answers are still in the Bible, and that's okay. She can believe that, you know.
Sure.
But, you know, as I was listening to her, you know, I come from a very similar background to what she comes from. I went through the whole born-again Christian thing. I believe, by the way, that my born-again experience with Jesus was very real. Now, I no longer believe in atonement and things like that. But I believe that my experience with God was extremely real. I had a very profound experience with asking Jesus into my heart and asking Jesus into my life. And I think that to the extent that born-again Christians lead people to that personal relationship, I think they're doing a fine job. There's unfortunately a lot of baggage surrounding that with blood atonement and other things that, you know, that the Bible teaches. But you know, I found myself wishing, you know, there's a part of me that wishes, God, I wish I could just go back to all that. I wish I could have it. You know, it's kind of like a child wanting to, you know, it's kind of like an adult wishing that he could become a child again. You know, there are times when we want to do that. It's, I guess, a form of reversion. You know, unfortunately, I can't. Unfortunately, I can't. I cannot go back to that, because I know now from the Urantia book what, you know, the truth about some of these things. But, you know, I understand her. I felt a sense of almost like she was grieving for her church. She was grieving for what these people could have, and for what, you know, because she you know, I could tell that Julia loves her faith, that it really means a lot to her. And so I just want to pray that she's not at peace now, but that she'll find deeper peace even than she has now. Whether she ever embraces the Arantia book or not is to me sort of a secondary issue. But I could just feel her heart. You know, I could feel her saying, you know, how deeply she loved her Christian faith and how sad she was to see this go on.
Yeah, I definitely feel that. And as I read her book, I felt her frustration and the frustration of the people that she interviewed. And what I find is, you know, I think that, you know, it would have been nice to talk to her for a couple of hours. I think we could easily have done that. But what I find is, you know, she mentions this early movement in the 70s, which I find interesting because many of us hippies came into the Arantia book movement then as well. There was something generational there that I think was a whole group of seekers, a wave, if you will, of people looking for something more. And when you first come to a faith and you find a faith, it's very satisfying. It's like, wow, I found it. This is my home. This is it. Oh, it's so exciting. And I think what she's saying and what she described is really what our movement has been through. We came in, we found it, we were so excited, we were thrilled, we were happy, and then all of a sudden the reality of movement politics, the reality of our own dysfunction, the reality of people who can't get along and conflict slapped us all in the face, and all of a sudden many of us became apathetic and dropped out of our involvement with the movement and said, when y'all figure it out, we'll be back, that kind of thing. So in a way, you know, it's painful to grow up. It's fun at first when you get into something. Like you said, Andre, you're a child. Okay, I'm a child, and now this is really fun and happy and everything. But all of a sudden, real-life problems hit, and this is the test of our character. And, you know, sometimes it's not about running away and throwing stone from the outside. It's about staying and working for change, working to make something more meaningful, even in the face of persecution, even in the face of, you know, and I'm not insinuating that Julia should stay with a church that's absolutely not feeding her, not at all. But I think, you know, sooner or later you can find something that's relatively better, more in
right.
line
I,
with
I think,
what you
I think,
want.
I think that I agree with what you're saying, Paul. I think that, yes, it is painful to grow up. Having said that, though, I think that we all have certain needs. They don't just disappear just because we grow up. And you know, just like a plant doesn't stop needing water or sun, you know. And
right.
I think that you know, we don't. I think that we, especially in America, we have this idea that, you know, now that we're grown up, and now I don't need my parents anymore, or now I don't need I can be on my own, stand on my own 2 feet. And that's not God didn't design us that way. We are not meant to be just isolated, go it alone kind of people. You know, he did create, and this is what the Bible calls the body of Christ and what the Arantia book would call, you know, the brotherhood of believers. You know, we need each other. We need that sense of community. Well, let me ask you this. Paula, did you find in the 70s when you were around in the Arantia movement, did you find that there were kind of Arantia book communes, the way she talked about Christian communes? Did you find that to be true as well?
Well, what I did find when I first came into the movement was much more of a free-flowing joy for being a part of something, and a happiness for being a part of it, and a willingness to join in, and a willingness to do, to work for it, to you know, and that was all kind of quelled when the split happened. And you know, it's been it's been hard to get that feeling back for a lot of people.
But what I'm talking about specifically, Paula, is you were talking about how
communes and that.
I mean, you were telling me before, for example, we had conversations about this off the air where you said people were more likely to open their homes to people. There was more of a sense, there was a sense of community that you felt, especially in Boulder during the 70s, that doesn't seem to be as prevalent now.
Well, right, and I think it's probably just what, you know, it's just what she's describing. It's a disappointment. We've been disappointed in each other. And for whatever reason, you know, in a sense, it's almost like we're giving up on each other and saying, well, it'll never happen. It's not what I wanted, and it's not what I thought it was going to be.
Right.
And so we walk away. And I'm not judging at all. I'm just saying I'm wondering out loud if that is the right tack to take, or if it would be better to try and change things from within.
Well, and the reason that I'm bringing this up, Paul, let me tell you why. I'm sorry to keep interjecting here. The reason I'm bringing this up is because I think that we as the Erasmus Creators have two opportunities. We have opportunities to provide intellectual answers to people who are having doubts, okay, who are dissatisfied with what they're hearing in the church. And that's really that's what I'm really trying to. That's one of the reasons I had Julia on, is because there are millions of people out there who love their church, they love their faith, but they're just not satisfied with the answers they're getting. So we have the opportunity to reach their minds. But we also have an opportunity, I believe, as believers, to create some of those communities. I mean, what is stopping? Maybe I'm asking a lot, but you know, what is stopping us from really helping us meet our brothers and sisters' needs? What is stopping us from having, you know, when I because I think some of the, we have our own problems in the Arantia community. I mean, when I first got involved in the Arantia movement, one of the reasons I gravitated though toward the Christian church. There were certain needs I wasn't getting met in the Urantia community. I mean, people would study the book intellectually, but I couldn't find people I could pray with. I couldn't find people that would talk to me about how to have a personal relationship with God. So my intellectual needs were getting met, but my heart needs were not getting met. Another thing, you know, what about service? What about opening our home to that single mom or to somebody who needs a place to stay for a month or whatever. Now, I'm not saying that we should be naive about it. I realize there are people that we can't trust. But the point I'm making is, you know, what can we be doing to help meet some of these needs? Because, again, here is another – I just look at this as another service opportunity. And if I had – right now I'm not in a position where I can do that, but if I had a place where I could, where I could open my home up to people who needed a place to stay, for example, you know, I'd do that in a heartbeat.
You know, I've pondered this a great deal. And should we follow the old paradigm? Should we go and be as a leaven in the dough? Should we get involved with churches and share our insights and share our greater teachings without saying where they're coming from for fear of being kicked out? Should we do all of the above? There's a huge phobia of church vacation in the Urantia movement, so I find this all very interesting, and it's certainly something that we as Urantia book readers should sit down and discuss and really think in earnest about this. I mean, I've done a lot of thinking about how we can serve the world, you know, what the Urantia book tells us, service to man, service to God, and service to the brotherhood of believers, the third and sacred obligation. And, you know, there's so few of us that, you know, we represent a very small group of people on this entire planet that have an epical revelation and believe in it, and we believe it is what it claims to be. So how can we step up our efforts to answer these many questions that people are having? And it's a double-edged sword because their theology oftentimes would prevent them from even giving us a chance to be heard. But we have a caller. Shall we take a call, Andre?
Absolutely.
514, you're on Blog Talk.
Hi, everyone. Paula.
Hi.
Andre.
Hi, Dan.
How are you?
Good.
I was just calling because I wanted to say I was listening to Julia as one of the audience, and it just occurred to me that this is most revealing of the state of affairs that's happening as a fact in the world right now. As I was telling you, Paula, I went to see the movie Religulous, and what Julia was exclaiming seems to be going on all over the world. It seems to be going right now, and I almost wish that she would listen to the program that you two did on the faith of Jesus when it was spoken about that growing phase, you know, the new growing phase that humanity is going through when shoes get to be too small and then you have to go into bigger shoes. And it has to do with an attitude. It's a time of welcoming this new phase. So, yes, there is frustration because you can see the pain that those small shoes are causing you. And you say, like, Mom, they hurt, you know, I can't wear them anymore. But then depending on the attitude, you can either remain frustrated or you can search for an answer, a solution. There's a solution for every problem. So this new phase of growth just demands to enlarge the attitude, the state of mind. And I just thought of mentioning this because the movie Religulous is as revealing as what Al Gore did for the ecology. This is doing it for religion, and I think that the faith of Jesus, the Urantia book, the revelation, as you mentioned so beautifully, Paula, the true teachings of Jesus are there to answer. I just felt inspired to say this because it is very revealing.
I agree, and I love your analogy of shoes that are too small. You know, sooner or later, when they get that painful, you're going to have to change your shoes. You're going to have to get a more comfortable pair of shoes and shoes that allow you to grow, because you simply cannot maintain that discomfort level for very long. Humans, you know, that's a good thing. We will be, you know, when the discomfort gets intense enough, we'll do something to change because we just can't stand it anymore. And sometimes you don't
find the store right away, you know, looking at shoes. Sometimes when you look for your special shoes, your new size of shoes, you don't find the store right away. So you have to keep shopping. You have to keep looking for the answer until you ask people. And sometimes, again, as you said, Paula, it's when you ask people, do you know something, and you talk about your problem, and my shoes are hurting me. Do you know where I could find the right shoes? And it's people that will one day or another give you the answer. I got my best shoes, the Urantia book. What a great size it is. It suits me perfectly well with my new set of belief, my new set of understanding. And then, you know, the transition is done, and you're into your new shoes, and then it feels great.
Well, you know, Diane, I want to kind of reiterate some things I was saying to Paula a few minutes ago, because I think after having looked at Julia's book, I think the two things that really stood out for me were there are two basic needs that the church is not meeting for people. One is an intellectual need that people have to have certain questions answered, to have their doubts answered. The other one is more, I guess you could say, spiritual and emotional as well. People want to be heard. They want to be affirmed. They want their feelings validated. Whether it's being single or the struggles of a single mom or whatever. And they also want to have needs met, and they also want to have help, practical help. Whether it's putting food on the table for their kids or babysitting or help finding a mate or whatever. I guess I what I'm trying to get at here is, you know, again, what can we as Urantia Book readers be doing to help people meet needs? Now, some of this, you know, is just something that we do in our daily lives, as we come into contact with people, whether they be friends or whatever. But I'm just wondering, again, what can we do as a Urantia community, you know, with our local study group, you know, instead of just sitting around studying the book intellectually, you know, what can we do to have a space for fellowship, for prayer, for group worship and meetings? What can we do, what about service projects? What about things like that? You know, if you look on the mansion world, what are the schools we're going to be in the next life? The schools of thinking, the schools of feeling, and the schools of doing. Wouldn't it be great if every study group, you know, had thinking, the intellectual part, the feeling, which would be group prayer, group worship, ministering to people's emotional needs, and doing, you know, what's stopping the study group from having a service project? You know, for so many years I've been in study groups and it's just been an academic discussion. And don't get me wrong, I love the Urantia book. I love the intellectual stuff in the book. Jesus tells us to love God with our heart, soul, and mind. So I'm not against in any way parsing the book and having hour-long, you know, discussions for hours about the intellectual content of the book. But if that's all we're doing, you know, we're missing something.
Well, you know, and I think Julia identified this very pattern for a problem in the churches and the congregations that she's interviewed. She said there seems to be an unwillingness to talk about the real issues, which is what humans need, the real human needs, to deal with human needs. There seems to be an unwillingness to do that, and I think that's also a cultural thing. We humans seem to be unwilling to go there. Andre, I admire you so much because you make yourself vulnerable and you express real human experiences that you're having. But many people don't do that, and they become very uncomfortable when other people do it. But until we become more willing to talk about our human condition and our human needs, we won't be able to address these problems. So my first thought on what you just said is, when are we going to admit that there's a need to get together and pray? That even believers in the Urantia book want to pray together, need that healing hurts kind of service, just what Julie
yes,
was talking
absolutely.
About. Tell me why I'm suffering. Please, somebody give me an answer.
Well, and I think one thing that's
and
happened,
to me,
too, and Nita, you can address this, Diane, too. I think one thing that's happened, I find, with a lot of your Urantia book readers is they say, well, my religion is personal. You know, it's private. You know, it's private. You know, well, personal doesn't mean private, though. You know, you can, I mean, Jesus tells us if we have, to not hide our light under a bushel. And again, I'm not telling people what to do. Some people are not comfortable praying out loud. I understand that. But there are a lot of us who do want people that we can pray with. And yes, listen, I have a personal prayer life with the Lord. I have a, I pray in my prayer closet. True. But I also, we also have a need to feel the touch of another human being and to know that they're praying with me. I remember one time I was at a Urantia conference recently in Kansas, a UAI conference back in July, and I was going through some real difficulties with a friend of mine back home. And I was not, in fact, it's funny because I went to two Urantia conferences this past summer, and I was not feeling very well at the time I went to both of those conferences. I was not in a good place. And thankfully, readers did minister to me, and this one particular woman, prayed with me. She held my hand. She prayed with me for like 5 minutes, and it was just so great to be able to share that with another reader, because so many readers I know are just they're just reluctant to pray out loud, and they're reluctant to pray for you and with you. And I just think that kind of stuff, that is something that churches have provided for people, although, as Julia said, they're not doing that great of a job right now. But, those are real human needs that I hope that we can begin to address as a community.
I think that what Julia was expressing also, Andrea and Paula, is the fact, it's an actual fact, that the organized religions, they are religions of authority. When you feel that you have authority on people, you already establish an imbalance relation of the two. You feel higher than, there's a lower one and there's a higher one, and you play the game of authority. And so people don't need anymore, as the true religion of Jesus is the religion of the Spirit, and the religion of Jesus, his religion of the Spirit, is based on one-to-one, heart-to-heart, soul-to-soul, spirit-to-spirit, and it's a religion of service. So to me personally, the best service we can do right now to people in need is not to try to push the Urantia book on their laps. They don't need a book. I think
That's right.
we
That's
need
right.
to be a living paper. We need to be a living proof of what we're reading. We need to be the action of what our mind is drinking in. We need to digest it and then put it into action on one-on-one. And what we need to do also is listen. Sometimes people, their heart is simply crying. They just need a shoulder. The other day I went out of my house. I was rushing out to the store. I saw a woman, an actual young girl. She was sitting on the bench. I live on a commercial area. She was sitting on the bench, and she was crying. She was literally sobbing. People were passing by. I stopped right away. I knelt down and right on her level, and I asked her what it was, if I could be of any help. And just like Jesus did as he passed by. And she actually told me that she was going through a very severe heartbreak and a lot of pain and all this. And we had a one-on-one meeting. I didn't need my Urantia book for that. It was actually in the house. But I tried to be a living paper, and it turned out to be so beautiful. I felt the true spirit of joy, the spirit of Jesus, run through my heart, because at the end of our meeting, her and me, I gave her a hug, and I saw her eyes shining, smiling, and it's like she had found her answer. So, and then I went on to the store, and I did my thing. So it's not to push that book on them, but then if we really learned our lesson, when you go to university and you learn your lesson, you left your book at you left your books at home, but you became an expression of that. So no more authority, no more I'm higher than you guys and I can tell you. No, I want to share with you. I want to be at your level and to be
and
in.
And think about that, Diane. Think about what you just said. It is so true and it's so profound because Jesus helped people to solve their own problems by what? By empowering
That's
them,
right.
by restoring their faith, by
That's right.
making them feel like they were worthy, by letting them know that they can come to their Heavenly Father in their own right, you know, that they can find Him in themselves, of themselves, for themselves. He empowered people, and the problem with religions of authority is they disempower people.
Mm-hmm.
And they make people feel like they're not worthy to come to God. They need a middleman. They need an intervener in some respect, you know, like a lawyer to plead their case to God.
That's right.
That God really doesn't want to deal with them directly. He will only deal with this person who is a step above, this person who is somewhat holier than they are. But Jesus didn't do that. He went down into the coal mines, right? He went to the crossroads and the caravans, and he spent time with people right where they live because he wanted to bring God to them and he wanted to bring them to God. And he, you know, it's like the Urantia book says, sometimes he did the most for somebody to whom he said the least. He just was there, present with them, holding
That's
their
right.
hand or whatever. It also says that Jesus would just smile on somebody, and it would increase that person's capacity to solve their own problems. You know, and how easy is it for us to just smile? Some of the most amazing experiences as a minister, and I'm talking about a minister in the sincerest sense of the word, folks. I'm not talking about ordination. I appreciate anybody who's ordained and anybody who has paid their dues with any religion and they've been trained as a theologian, or I appreciate anybody who's worked for a degree. These are not easy things to do, and I salute you all. But I'm talking about ministry when you're called, just what Diane just described. When you see a need and you stop and you fill that need, there's a quote in the Urantia book which I dearly love. It says, wherever there is a great need in a creature, wherever there's a great need for love, the more divine love seeks to fill that need. If we are conduits of divine love, then when we see a need in our fellows for love, for sympathy, for understanding, for a listening ear, a caring heart, because we are conduits of God's love, we will fill that need. We will sit down with that person and listen. We will do what that person did with you, Andre. We'll sit and hold your hand and pray with you if that's what you need. Some of the greatest experiences I've had have been those experiences where I did good as I passed by, like the man I related a few weeks ago with Pato. I prayed with him while he sat on that bench on the street because he asked me to.
And that is the true acid test of our faith. You know, we claim right and left that Jesus is alive. Well, we've got to put him to test. And that is that when those situations happen, like that girl I met, if we truly connect and just simply ask, surrender our will to Jesus' will, to God's will, the answers come. You just need to ask. That's the true acid test of faith. That's when faith becomes living faith, not intellectual faith, but practical, living, factual, actual faith. And the words come out of your mouth, the gestures come out, you hug the person, you look at the person right straight in the eyes, and the person feels that you are meeting at the soul level. You're not meeting just at the blah, blah level. You're meeting at the heart level. You can feel that she feels you understand. And so that is, to me, the living spirit of Jesus through his living faith. So we just got to trust him in true sense of the word, and then the work gets done. So when we do that, we are equal, as opposed to the religion of authority, which to me is dying, it's crumbling, it's absolutely beautiful to watch, and especially with a positive attitude, the state of affairs is that the shoes are too small, let's move on, let's not blame, let's not attack, let's just look for those great shoes, because there's a lot of work to do, and we need, the road is long, we need to get going. And
yes,
I'll leave you
really
on that.
Fun. Yeah, thank you, Diane.
Diane.
And you know what? I think that as Diane was talking about the religion of authority, I think, and I agree with you, Paula, that I have a lot of respect for people who are ordained. But I also would say that, you know, the Erasmus tells us that Jesus was a layman. He was a layman.
Yeah.
He was just like, and so part of the problem is this whole, part of what creates this religion of authority is this whole distinction between clergy and lady, and then what ends up happening is the clergy get put on a pedestal. And so it creates this opportunity, unfortunately, for self-righteousness. But you know, I guess what I want to get back to again, though.
Bye, everyone.
Bye, Diane.
Goodbye,
Thank
Diane.
You.
Goodbye.
Love.
Diane.
Bye.
What I want to get back to is yes, we definitely have opportunities as individuals to meet needs, people's needs, and to serve in our everyday lives, and that's definitely something we should be doing. I guess the one of the things I kept coming back to, though, in Julia's book, one of the chapters was about the need for community. So again, you know, we have a need. We have a need for an extended family in our lives. You know, and that's, I guess, again, what I want to, you know, would like to see us think about as Erasmus Book readers is, you know, what can we do to start helping each other fulfill that need? Not just to outsiders, but to us as Erasmus, you know, as Erasmus Book readers, we have that need as well. You know, one of the things, Paula, that I discovered, too, when I was first going into Erasmus study groups, you know, I think that there's such a fear among Erasmus Book readers of being too much like a church that sometimes we don't meet basic needs. I'll give you an example. A new person would come to a meeting, and, you know, and they were so afraid that they didn't want to be pushy with them about the Erasmus Book, so, you know, there was no attempt really to make them feel welcome. You know, I'm thinking, well, why can't we have the person fill out a welcome card? Why don't we follow up, give them a call, say, did you enjoy yourself? Would you like to come back? There was none of that because they were so afraid of, you know, of coming across as high pressure or too pushy, and they didn't want to do anything like that. But, you know, I just know that if I you know, wasn't so interested in the Erasmus Book, if I was not as interested as I am, a friend of mine introduced me to it, but if that was my first exposure to the Erasmus Book, I don't know if I'd want to come back to that meeting, you know, because people—it's like people didn't seem to care that I even existed. I don't mean to make terrible generalizations, because Erasmus Book readers are some of the most wonderful people I've ever met in my life. I'm just telling you that there was a mentality, especially back in the late '80s when I first started, among certain groups, you know, that they were so afraid, as I said, of being perceived as a church that they didn't want to do certain basic things.
Well, and I think you're absolutely right, Andre. I think that we. And you've said this many times, I think we throw the baby out with the bathwater. Christianity and churches have done many wonderful things for people. I always remember Nelson Mandela's speech to the parliament in South Africa in 1999. And Mandela, who is an amazing human being, obviously, got up and stood in front of all of these religionists at the parliament of the world's religions and said, you know, when I was languishing in prison, when I had nobody who cared about me and my compatriots were there with me and nobody cared about them, it was you, it was all of you who came and ministered to us. It was you, the Muslims. It was you, the Christians. It was you, the Hindus, who mm-hmm. came and ministered to us. You saved me. If it wasn't for you, I wouldn't be here. And I think that, you know, we need to look at that and see that the spirit of the love of God moves even religions of authority, all of us, to do wonderful things. And, you know, I point out that in paper 99, The Social Problems of Religion, and I may have said this before, and forgive me if I have, but it bears repeating, I think, Section 6, Institutional Religion, it says there is a real purpose in the socialization of religion. It is the purpose of group religious activities to dramatize the loyalties of religion, to magnify the lures of truth, beauty, and goodness, to foster the attractions of supreme values, to enhance the service of unselfish fellowship, to glorify the potentials of family life, to promote religious education,
to provide wise counsel and spiritual guidance, and to encourage group worship. And all live religions encourage human friendship, conserve morality, promote neighborhood welfare, and facilitate the spread of the essential gospel of their respective messages of eternal salvation. I mean, that says it right there. This is what we should be striving for. This is the benefit of us socializing as religionists, and these are so important. I mean, think about it. Dramatize the loyalties of religion. Magnify the lures of truth, beauty, and goodness. Foster the attractions of supreme values. Enhance the service of unselfish fellowship. Glorify the potentials of family life. Promote religious education. Provide wise counsel and spiritual guidance. Encourage group wisdom. Encourage friendship, morality, neighborhood welfare, and the essential gospel of eternal salvation. My gosh! What are we waiting for? You know, and this is exactly as I was reading Julia's book, saying these are what she's saying. People are saying, wow, yeah, this is what we're not getting. So we have the pattern right here. They've told us the format, the formula. If we want to succeed in socializing religion, this is what we need to do. These are the values we need to hold up and hone in on, not the dogma, not the theology or whatever. We need to hone in on what matters most, and here it is. And this is the value and the benefit.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Andre,
and Jesus says, you know, how are they going to know, people going to know that they're my disciples? By how we love one another. So how do we, you know, again, what are we doing to show that to people, to the outside world, you know, not just as individuals, but as a community of readers and of believers in the Arantia book. So I really hope that I've, you know, I'm not trying to give people lectures here, but I hope that I've encouraged people to think, you know, outside the box, as we're trying to do in this series, to show people that, hey, you know, there is people have real needs, they have real hungers, real desires, and, you know, what can we do to help minister to those needs?
Andre, I have identified, at least in my own personal life, that people have certain basic needs that are just so basic to who we are. One is we want to be accepted, right? We want to feel like we belong to somebody, to something. So we want to be accepted. We want to be forgiven.
Yes.
Because we all make mistakes.
Yes.
We want to feel like we're accepted and forgiven for our own foolish humanness, let's put it that way. And three, we want to be loved. We want to feel like we have value. And we are loved for that value. We are loved for what it is about us that is good and real. And, you know, those are the things we all want. And yet, in my experience, we find it hard to give those things, right? We're impatient with each other. We get testy. We don't like, you know. We hone in on the negative instead of accepting, you know, understanding, forgiving, and loving. These are the things we all want. But it just seems to me like it's the hardest. These are the hardest things for us to give. And the lesson, I think, that Jesus was trying to tell us was, if this is what you want, this is what you must give.
Mm. But you know what? It's interesting. Jesus also said, though, that his yoke was easy and his burden was light. And I think that I find that don't get me wrong, I'm not saying it's all going to be a rose garden, but I find that because there are going to be times when it is going to be hard to love. And how do we love those who are unlovable? That's really difficult. And there are times when we're all unlovable. There are times when I'm not lovable. But having said that, I find that the healthiest relationships I have are ones where it really, I don't even have to make any effort. It's natural for me to love that person. It's natural for them to love me back. And so, how do we create those kinds of relationships? And I think that what I found is in places where community is really active and functioning well, it brings out the best in you. It brings out your best self. And then as the Arantia book says, if you really get to know your fellows, you'll fall in love with them. And I think that if we can create environments where we can get to know each other really get to know each other. You know, I remember...
There you go, Andre. I think you hit the nail right on the head. Getting to know one another. Because the Urantia book says it so succinctly. Jesus says it so succinctly. If you can get to know your fellows, understand their motives and sentiments,
mm-hmm.
you will eventually fall in love with them. So there it is.
Yeah.
We have
yeah,
to create
really
an environment.
About. That's really
yeah.
what it's about.
And
so.
And in a way, Andre, what a good church provides and what we could provide as Urantia Book readers is the leadership that holds that vision up and
mm-hmm.
says what's most important is that we get to know each other and fall in love with each other.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's really what is missing, I find, with some of the study groups. And I find that some of the study groups I'm in, the people I just study the book with, but they're not really my friends. And again, I realize you can't be friends with everybody. I understand that. But, you know, the more we can do that, the better. I mean, you know, I remember when I was at the conference I was at in Kansas City, one of my dear friends, Harry Menton, spoke. And one of the things he was talking about the youth movement in the Urantia movement. There's a youth movement that they just kind of tour the country and hang out with each other. And people will ask them things like, what are you guys doing? Are you doing study groups? Are you doing service projects? Who's paying for this? You know, and Harry's whole point was, look, all that matters is that we're getting to know each other. Isn't that enough? You know, I mean, and also, you know, the Urantia movement is in its infancy. And I think that for a movement in its infancy, you know, getting to know each other is probably the most important thing we can do right now, because how can we lead and have a shared vision if we don't get to know each other? How can we make it work? You know.
I absolutely agree. You know, Bro Dave on the board made a comment just now. Getting to know one another is best done in the nuclear family arena, and you know, and he has also made several comments about in-home study groups and sitting in the living room and stuff. And I have to agree, and Julie, I think, identified that as a trend, people meeting in their homes, and that's been going on for some time. And I think there's something about that intimacy where we're sitting down in the living room, we're not in a formal building, we're not expected to do anything sing-songy or traditional or anything. We're just being ourselves. And we're not expected to dress up or not dress up. I mean, it's just come and sit in my living room, study this book, let's talk about spiritual things, and let's be ourselves.
And let's
and,
share,
and
also, there's a great Bible verse, too, and I wish I had brought this up when Julie was on the air, but I didn't think about it, apologies, but it says, Paul is talking, he says, you became so dear to us that we shared not only the gospel with you, but our lives as well. People want people that they can share their lives with. You know, they want to, you know, it's not just yes, we do need to study the book, and I'm glad we've got the book, but it's not only that. You know, I want people, I think we all want people in our lives that we can talk to about our daily struggles, our daily joys, you know, and again, that's part of getting to know people.
It is, and you know, the thing I can tell you, Andre, because I've studied with a group of Urantians since 1977, and certainly I've studied in several different groups. I remember when I studied, the first study group I studied with on a regular basis, we met in two different homes. We alternated every other week, and we were all 20-somethings, and then we were 30-somethings, and then we were 40-somethings, and these friends that I made back there in 1978 and 79 are still like my family today. And when my first husband was killed in a car accident in 1982, the first people I called were two women in that group. They called the rest of the entire community, and that community rallied around me. I mean, I can never express enough how much that meant to me to have those good people of faith standing by my side, willing at a moment's notice to do anything for me and my kids that we needed.
And that's exactly what community is about. That's exactly, I think, what Julia is talking about in her book, that people are hungry for. That's exactly the kind of real intimacy, real servanthood, real service that we're talking about. That's actually, it's even, I'll make it even simpler. That's real friendship, isn't it?
It is. And those friendships that I made with people like Mo Siegel, Joanne Weidman, Linda and Jim McNally, you know, and I got Andre Redatus and Chris Riggio, and oh my gosh, these people are like my family. And you know, we get mad at each other sometimes, just like a family
does.
But we don't, but that never, that feeling of familial love for one another, that we are brought together by this most amazing book that tells us, in reality, kids, you are family.
Well, exactly. And I'm so glad you said that, Paula, because, and I don't want to, just to kind of qualify slightly what Brother Dave was saying on the board, unfortunately, some of us don't come from good families or from functional families. I grew up in a very screwed up family, unfortunately. It was verbal abuse and a lot of other stuff going on that just wasn't, you know, and I didn't feel comfortable being with my family. And I needed an extended family. I needed a family outside of my family, a real family, a spiritual family where I could, I think one of the things we could be doing as well is adopting people. And I don't mean legally adopting children, although that's a whole other discussion. But what I mean is, in a sense, adopting people, saying, hey, you know what? You're one of us. You can be part of our family. You can be part of our home. My house is your house, kind of thing. And again, I'm not suggesting that we do that with every person. I understand that there are people you can't trust, you can't let into your life. I understand that. But to the extent that we can do that, the rewards of that are so far outweigh any so-called sacrifices or costs because, you know, the relationships that you build through doing that, you know, that's a huge return on your investment.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, imagine, I mean, I think the hardest thing for us humans to do is to get over our prejudices and our judgments about certain things. And I think we see this in Christianity as a good example, you know. They're Christians, but they don't believe exactly like I do. Therefore, they can't be, the kinds of Christians that God really appreciates. Or, you know, we make these distinctions. We find these things, and we have them in the Urantia book movement, too. And I'm not going to mention them because, man, I don't want to see the board explode with this controversy, which always happens. I've been on many discussion boards, and I see it over and over again. But we have our bugaboos, the things that we don't like about ourselves that we kind of hone in on, and we get judgmental about those things. And I think that, you know, aside from that, when Jesus, and this is why I mentioned a couple weeks ago, one of my favorite sections of the book is the discourse on religion and the second discourse on religion, because Jesus essentially tells us that we will never all think alike. We can
That's
spiritually
right.
be alike. We can, and if we hold on to that, if we hold on to our spiritual similarities, that is, we have one Father, one spiritual Father is the first source and center of all things. He's the first source and center of me. He's the first source and center of you. He's the first source and center of paradise. He's at the center of every automaton. We can hold on to that. That is our unity. We can have spirit unity. But we don't have to be uniform. We don't all
That's
have
right.
to believe alike. And, in fact, Jesus says that is not possible. That will never happen.
And you know what? It wouldn't be desirable because the fact is that none of us has all the answers. So if we all thought the same way, we wouldn't get a lot of answers to questions. You know, there are things, there are places, you know, there are people that I know that are better, you know, have insights that I don't have, and I have insights that other people don't have. So if we all thought the same way, there would be no way for us to grow.
All right. And you know, I think that there's a real movement afoot to celebrate diversity and to honor diversity. And one of the things I love so much about the interfaith movement is you learn so much from other religionists if you just listen. If you know, and what's been beautiful about participating in the Parliament of the World's Religions has been the fact that the religionists that are there are comfortable with their own spirituality. They're now willing and ready to open up to the spirituality of others. And so there's a genuine and sincere celebration of sharing going on there, which is just thrilling to me. And you see that in the interfaith movement. People who are comfortable with their own faith are now willing to share the faith of others and find the similarities and not get hung up on the differences, and that's really refreshing. And,
yes.
You know, so I don't know. I want to thank you, Andre, for doing this series, Thinking Outside the Box, because I think that it's wonderful that we can do this and we can have somebody like Julia Dean on and talk to her about her book. And you never cease to amaze me how you go out and get folks like her. You're a very courageous human being.
Thank you. And next week we're going to have a real treat for those who are listening. We're going to have Carlton Pearson on. Carlton Pearson is a he's a guy who he was a black pastor in Tulsa, Oklahoma, who had a church of several thousand people, big part of the charismatic sort of Pentecostal movement out there, and it was involved with Oral Roberts University. And then he lost a lot of his a whole lot of his flock when he decided to reject the doctrine of hell and eternal damnation. He's got a book called The Gospel of Inclusion. And I'm just really, and I know, Paula, you're really looking forward to this interview next week as well.
Well, you know, it's funny because we had somebody on the board earlier who was saying how much they admired Jesus for being willing to stand up for the truth. And then we had another person who is a practicing pastor who, for whatever reason, can't exactly do that right now. And I understand his, he's a practicing minister, and I understand the difficult position he's in, and I also understand that there's a lot of Urantia Book readers out there in churches who are doing good work. They're like the leaven in the dough. They're like Diane was saying, they are the papers. They're living the papers by being the truth, but they don't necessarily have to say where they're getting it. You know what I mean? Because
yes.
They understand all too
well. I want to make sure I get one point, because thing that may have made our audience a little uncomfortable was Julia said, you know, she was kind of giving the traditional Christian response. You know, well, Jesus said he was the only way. Okay, let's talk about that a little bit, because Jesus did say he's the way, the truth, and the life, and no man comes to the Father but through him. But what does that mean for us as Urantia Book readers? And even from a Christian point of view, we can say this. What that means is that Jesus is like a window or a lens through which we see God. And I know that's a very visual metaphor that I'm giving, even though I can't see. But, you know, if we want to know what God is like, all we have to do is look at Jesus, because Jesus is the time-space equivalent, the time-space representation to us here in our local universe of who God is. So in that sense, he is the way. You know, for us in our local universe, he is the way to the Father. So, you know, it doesn't mean if you don't accept Jesus, you're going to hell. It just means, you know, because we're finite and God is infinite, Jesus is God's way of the infinite becoming finite so that we can understand him. It's kind of like what you mentioned Earl Strider said before. He said, you know, Jesus makes God's hand small enough to hold. So I just wanted to kind of clarify that for people that, yes, Jesus is the way. But you know, we have because of our revelation, we have an enhanced understanding of what that means. But even without the Urantia Book, you probably could come to that same conclusion.
Well, and I think, you know, what occurs to me sometimes is when people say that to you, when Christians say that to you, in a way what they mean is Christianity is the way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which is not necessarily true. And I think what we're getting at here in this series, Andre, is that the church or religion, Diane mentioned a religious that Bill Maher did, the church or the current religious thinking is not God. God is apart from that. That is just the way that we reach out for that great reality that is God, but we don't have it all figured out yet. So I think what all religionists need to do is make that distinction that the church is not God. Christianity is not Jesus. Christianity is a religion about Jesus, but it's not Jesus. Jesus is the way.
That's right.
That doesn't necessarily mean that Christianity is the only way.
Right. Well,
so
because,
I think that's the distinction.
Yeah, and I think because Christians believe that Jesus founded the Christian church, they believe he founded the Christian religion, so it's hard for them to make a distinction between Christianity and Jesus. But we do know that there is a difference.
Thank you, Andre.
You're welcome. Thanks again for listening to Cosmic Citizen.